From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. The void where the World Trade Centers stood has been called a monument of air. On today's Fresh Air, we discuss what should become of that space with architect and critic Anthony Vidler. He's acting dean of the Cooper Union School of Architecture in New York City. Also, the task of starting over again and reinventing itself is something that New York City has done before. We talk with director Rick Burns about his PBS documentary series on the history of New York, and with commentator Peter Quinn, a third-generation New Yorker and Irish-American. Book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews the novel London Bridges by Jane Stevenson, and film critic John Powers reviews Ben Stiller's new film Zoolander. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First News.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. President Bush says the United States is in hot pursuit of the terrorists behind the September 11th attacks. Meanwhile, the Pentagon has begun a redeployment of ships, planes, and personnel around the globe to prepare for a military strike, but officials have said little to suggest any type of attack is imminent. A Pakistani delegation has failed to persuade Afghanistan's Taliban rulers to surrender Osama bin Laden. He's the main suspect in the September 11th attacks. From Islamabad, NPR's Eric Weiner reports.
This is the second time in as many weeks that a Pakistani delegation has returned from Afghanistan empty-handed. Earlier this month, a team of senior Pakistani military officers tried and failed to convince the Taliban leader to hand over Osama bin Laden. The hope was that this time the presence of several highly respected Muslim clerics would help sway the Taliban leadership, but that did not happen. According to one Pakistani cleric who attended the talks, Mullah Omar, the Taliban leader, refused to even discuss the status of bin Laden, saying it was the United States that needs to, quote, abandon its stubbornness. "I don't believe that Mullah Omar is afraid of war," the Pakistani cleric said. But both Pakistan and the Taliban have left the door open for future talks. Eric Weiner, NPR News, Islamabad.
A man accused of illegally obtaining a license to transport hazardous materials by truck is in custody in Chicago. The FBI identifies him as Fadil Al-Khalidi of Detroit. Officials say he was arrested last night. He's one of about 20 men being investigated for getting bogus licenses amid fears of more terrorist attacks. But the FBI has said the suspects were not linked to the September 11th attacks. The crackdown on the U.S.-Mexico border following the terrorist attacks is having an unintended consequence. Illegal drug shipments from Mexico have plummeted. NPR's Jerry Haddon reports from Mexico City.
X-ray machines, drug-sniffing dogs, and exhaustive searches by U.S. Border Patrol agents appear to be scaring away drug shippers. According to the U.S. Customs Service, the amount of drugs seized since September 11th has dropped by 80%. Officials say drug dealers have made a deliberate business decision to scale back border crossings in the face of high scrutiny. But they caution the drop-off is likely to be temporary, as drug gangs seek alternate routes for their cocaine, marijuana, and other products. Drug dealing is a multi-billion dollar business, and sellers are likely feeling the pressure to bring their product to market in order to pay off suppliers. In Mexico, that pressure may be particularly high on marijuana growers at the moment, who are about to harvest their latest crop. Jerry Haddon, NPR News, Mexico City.
Stock prices were higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 165 points to close at 88.47, volume 1,600,000,000 shares. The S&P 500 rose 32 points to finish at 1040, and the Nasdaq was up 37. You're listening to NPR News. The Airline Pilots Association is easing off its request to let pilots carry firearms in the cockpits. They're leaning towards stun guns instead. Congress had offered only a lukewarm reception to their initial idea. Union President Dwayne Wirth says there's much wider support for stun guns. He also says government officials put airlines on notice that some of their planes might be needed by the military. Palestinians today mark the first anniversary of their uprising against Israeli occupation with 3 minutes of silence and marches throughout the West Bank and Gaza Strip. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Tensions were running high throughout the West Bank and Gaza Strip today after Israeli troops shot dead 5 Palestinians in the Gaza Strip yesterday. The new violence came just one day after Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat and Israeli Foreign Minister Shimon Peres met and pledged to enforce a ceasefire. Palestinians throughout the territories planned large marches to mark the one-year anniversary of the uprising, in which more than 700 people, three-quarters of them Palestinians, have died. Israeli officials said the marches could turn violent and threaten the fragile ceasefire. Israel also said it would limit access to the Muslim holy site of the Al-Aqsa Mosque to men over age 40. It was Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's visit to the site that sparked the first clashes that led to the uprising. Linda Gradstein, NPR News, Jerusalem.
In Montana, five homes were evacuated today as firefighters tried to stop a wildfire that has scorched 4,000 acres, about 60 miles northwest of Yellowstone National Park. The fire started early Wednesday and spread quickly as it burned in heavy timber and moved to the north and east. I'm Frank Stacio, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Wellington Management, providing investment advice to clients worldwide, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. As workers continue the agonizing task of clearing and cataloging the rubble at the site where the World Trade Center once stood, a debate has already begun about what should fill the hole left by terrorism. Some have proposed rebuilding the Twin Towers exactly as they were, as an act of defiance and optimism, the sooner the better. Others support establishing a park, a place of beauty and peace, to memorialize the victims and help the city heal. Most agree that the tragedy is an opportunity to reconsider what kind of city New York is in the wake of the attacks, and that whatever rises at the site should reflect the city's new identity. My guest, Anthony Vidler, is acting dean of the Cooper Union School of Architecture in New York City. He's currently on leave as professor of art history and architecture at UCLA and is the author of Warped Space: Art, Architecture, and Anxiety in Modern Culture. I asked him what architectural vision the World Trade Center reflected when it was conceived back in the 1960s.
Well, I think it was the apotheosis of an architecture of business, of an architecture of communication and flow and international global trade and commerce that really began in this country to take flight in the late 1940s and 50s. I would say that the first buildings, if you like, to symbolize this sense of an architecture of business, a business art, as architects used to call it, they were buildings that were built, as C. Wright Mills said it very pertinently, as almost as giant file cabinets for the efficient organization of business. And it seems to me that the World Trade Center, with its massive pileup of floors, its extraordinary, if you like, almost anonymity of the external appearance, was in a sense the largest version of this great office building boom that took off after the war.
Another word that gets kicked around when people talk about this vision of efficiency in business is transparency. This was the
right.
Transparent architecture. What did they mean by that?
Well, in the 1920s and 30s, when architects in Europe and especially began to frame the terms in which modern architecture or modernist architecture might be built, they were extremely excited about the new materials, new industrial materials of iron, glass, steel, glass, concrete, about the possibilities of buildings, in a sense, bringing light into their interiors. And of course, in an office building, one of the most important questions before the major introduction of artificial lighting systems was to bring light into a deep interior so that Secretary Pools and the executives could work in daylight. Secondly, in the 20s and 30s, there was a tremendous utopian enthusiasm for the rebuilding of cities that had been caked in soot and dirt and grime from the Victorian steam age, so to speak, and the notion of these glistening glass towers which, if they were glass, seemed to dissolve into refracted light. The Pepsi-Cola building or Manufacturers Trust building in New York are very, very powerful visions of that transparency. If you think of the Manufacturers Trust building, which has this great safe, the bank safe, transparently exposed, and in the center of it, you have a sense of how these buildings should have were imagined as public buildings, as belonging to the public, as accessible to the public, and as part of a new, glistening, modern utopia.
You've written that in certain terms, the skyscrapers were meant to dispel people's fears of city life, to dispel their neuroses about the closeness of it, which is really ironic when you think that skyscrapers have ended up being such a focus of fear and anxiety for people.
It's interesting because in my book Warp Space, I talk about the way in which city space has, since the late 19th century, been seen by inhabitants of cities as a kind of locus, as a place which, if you like, embodies their various fears, anxieties, what Freud called neuroses. That we've seen that in the opening up and broadening of the boulevards in Paris, many people describe sensations which we now call agoraphobic, and we've seen that in the condensed apartment buildings that became a way of life in the modern cities in the late 1930s, 20th century, people experienced what is now called claustrophobia. Doctors tended in those days to literalize people's anxieties in such a way as ascribing them directly to the places in which they found themselves, to the places in which they felt those anxieties. I think in the 1920s, there were some 400 or 500 different phobias, many, many, many of which were ascribed to place, to sites, acrophobia, fear of heights on acropolises, and so on and so forth. So yes, indeed, there are many, many places. I don't know a space in modern society that has not been attributed to the inspiration of one phobia or another.
I'm speaking with Anthony Vidler. He's the acting dean at the Cooper Union School of Architecture. He's also the author of Warp Space, Art, Architecture, and Anxiety in Modern Culture. How do you see the September 11th attack changing or challenging our ideas about the city, given that there's always been this split in the image of New York between people who saw it as pure possibility and a place where miracles happened and it was the biggest and the best and it welcomed everyone? And then, on the other hand, there was the idea that it's a scary, crime-ridden and decadent, arrogant place, our national mammon. Have the attacks changed those polar images of New York?
Not so much about how you design cities in the wake of terrorism, because I think there's no way in which you can design cities in the wake of terrorism. This is a specific kind of attack. It will change its nature over and again. Terrorism doesn't know cities to attack. It knows only sites and specific moments. And so, for me, it's an opportunity to rethink the difficulties and problems that we have had in shaping and framing architectural spaces for living and working in cities of high density since the Second World War. And I think that it would be a shame to repeat the difficulties of the overdevelopment of the 60s, for example, simply because we feel it's a brave and proud act to rebuild exactly as it was before.
You just said that you can't design for security. You can't design against a terrorist attack. I think someone was quoted saying, you can't design for the epicenter of an earthquake.
Exactly.
Is that what you mean? It's not...
In the sense that we design for living. We don't design for dying. We design for community. We don't design for specific moments. My sense is that to design a city of checkpoints, of surveillance, of video cams, of stop and go, of identity cards, would be a city not worth living in. And it would also be a very difficult city to escape from. I think one of the interesting lessons we learned in, unfortunately and unhappily, on September 11th was in fact the permeability and the openness of the and the number of ways of leaving the site was an aid to the escape of those who fortunately were able to survive the bombing. And so I think that no amount of if you like, designing for space being defensible will necessarily defend space. I think it's up to us to defend space by our community activities, by the life we live in it, by the kinds of values we project from it, and the rest, I would say, is up to a very good, equitable foreign policy.
In terms of learning from history, what worked about the site? What worked about the Twin Towers?
Well, as you know, the Twin Towers were very contentious when they were first built, both as objects and as objects of such enormous size.
They were those big, windswept, freezing in the winter and barren in the summer. They inspired very little human feeling.
In those terms, yes. But also, I think when we're thinking of urban life, we think of a mix of activities, and what I think the density of commercial space in that area has up to quite recently precluded was the development of small-scale businesses, of the kinds of businesses that support everyday living activities. Park spaces have only very recently and almost reluctantly been inserted into areas that are needed now for those who live in Battery Park and even around the municipal center. So there are dozens of stories that I've heard from architects and others of those who are bringing up the second wave of children in these areas. And it would be, I think, a great shame to ignore that this has become a vital area of living for New Yorkers and not just an area of commerce.
I'm speaking with Anthony Vidler. He's the acting dean at the Cooper Union School of Architecture. He's a professor of art history and architecture at UCLA, currently on leave from that university. We'll talk more about the various proposals for rebuilding the site of the World Trade Center after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Anthony Vidler. He's acting dean at the Cooper Union School of Architecture. He's also the author of Warped Space, Art, Architecture, and Anxiety in Modern Culture. Were you in New York on September 11th?
I was indeed.
And what did you see of the attack?
I saw every moment of the drama of the World Trade Center from the roof of the Cooper Union, then down on the ground a little closer, and from almost a second or two after the first strike.
Given your background, and I don't assume that this is what would be going through your mind when you're watching such a horrific event, but did you have an engineer's sense of how the buildings would stand the impact of the planes and the fire?
I had an instantaneous sense of a kind of a brilliant, almost architectural, rendered image of the interior of these office floors, of the interior of the escape stairs, of the interior of the elevators, and of what was happening inside. And I can't say that was anything but I just felt entirely suffocated. I was amazed, actually, to tell you the truth, at how long each of the two buildings stood. I was told by the responsible engineer for the two towers were in fact built to withstand the impact of a 727, not necessarily at that height and not necessarily loaded with so much fuel, but indeed they stood, one of them for nearly an hour, one of them for over an hour, allowing for thousands of those on the floors below the impact to escape. And so in that respect, I would say that the engineering was as good as it could have been in the 60s.
In the wake of the terrorist attacks, are there specific recommendations for safety measures that you think architects will be inserting into their plans?
I would obviously ask for much wider fire stairs that are not based on the calculation of the amount of rentable space you can get if they're smaller, and so on and so forth, and much tougher structures. But again, as we understand, nothing can withstand nuclear attack. We can't build buildings, and we didn't build buildings throughout the 50s and 60s during the great time of fear and threat of nuclear annihilation. I don't think we can build buildings for the threat of terrorism. I do think we can reflect on safety in high buildings. One of the interesting facts I uncovered in looking through the history of tall buildings in Manhattan is that after one of the first fatal fires in a skyscraper in Manhattan, a much lower skyscraper, of course, in 1912, a commission reported to the city that perhaps the height of skyscrapers should be calibrated in terms of the time that it takes to evacuate the inhabitants of that building in relationship to its ability to withstand fire.
Now, you're acting dean at the Cooper Union, which is downtown. Now that the towers are no longer there, some people have, in the neighborhood, have talked of losing their bearings. Have you felt that?
It's true that architecture very quickly, whether it's vilified or not vilified, becomes a landmark. I remember the tremendous debates over the construction of the Eiffel Tower, which was in Paris, which was supposed to be a temporary structure. And when it didn't come down, people were outraged. And I always remember the story of the novelist Maupassant, who was asked why, if he hated the tower so much, did he lunch there every morning on the top of the tower? He said, "Well, quite frankly, it's the only place in Paris from which I cannot see the tower." And so it is true that buildings become landmarks, and certainly the World Trade Center. I came to this country before it was built in the early 60s, and I was then teaching in Princeton, and every time I came to New York and saw these towers rising, they became the natural landmark of, the sort of moment of, oh, finally I'm getting to the city and back to street life again. Peter Wheelwright, the chair of architecture at Parsons School, who lives very close to the towers and was evacuated very quickly, spoke the other night of the way in which the towers were the place that he pointed his children to if they got lost. You know, just if you get lost downtown, just make for those towers and you're home. So yes, they become a landmark, but it's quite clear that other landmarks will take their place. It's very interesting how now we see the old skyscrapers almost so much more clearly. We see the Woolworth Building actually as the landmark that it was originally meant to be.
There was a recent New York Times article on this debate about rebuilding the site, and the point was made that the towers were built at a time when New York was aspiring to be a global financial center, that it was staking its claim very loudly and emphatically. But now that position is secure, and I think the quote was, "It need only whisper its intent." It's an interesting call for subtlety in architecture, in remembrance. Do you have an idea of a vision of that?
In a way, I would rephrase that first statement, and I was saying yes, they were built at a time when high buildings represented that aspiration. In other words, the notion of building taller and taller and taller and taller. Remember Frank Lloyd Wright at one point in his career coming out and demanding a mile-high skyscraper for Chicago. There's a sense that this has always been a kind of almost aesthetic aspiration to symbolize power. I think that if we look at some of the other proposals of the 60s for occupying the World Trade Center site with the World Trade Center, there's a very elegant proposal by Skidmore, Owings and Merrill, which is a very relatively low, flat, you know, pancake building with courtyards in it, and a very small scale slab, rather like that of the United Nations building beside it. I would think that it's possible for institutions to have power without necessarily symbolizing that power through height. Maybe it's time for institutions, especially public institutions, to demonstrate a kind of openness to access as opposed to a parade of symbolic monumentality.
Do you have different ideas about what architecture means to us, or the strength of our attachment to buildings as symbols after experiencing the terrorist attacks?
Well, I think what is very, very clear and has been clear is that whatever the architects of buildings and spaces intend originally, whatever the clients of those buildings and spaces intend for the architect to symbolize initially, is radically transformed by use, radically transformed by time and history. And symbolic associations shift as our understanding of the importance and nature of institutions shifts. So what can be symbolic of a great aspiration one day becomes symbolic of an evil intention the next, for example. We saw that in the monumental pomp of National Socialism, for example, in Germany in the 30s and 40s. I have no single answer about what kind of architecture makes a particular kind of symbolic effect or resonance on a population. It changes as populations, aspirations, and natures themselves change. So my sense is that you never can tell.
Anthony Vidler, thank you very much for talking with me today on Fresh Air.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Anthony Vidler is acting dean of the Cooper Union School of Architecture. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. From Book Magazine, for the passionate reader, featuring books, authors, and articles that read between the lines, in bookstores and online at bookmagazine.com. And from Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Officer of the Court, a suspense novel of World War II by Bill Macy Jr., author of The Advocate. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we take a look at how New York City has responded to earlier catastrophes with Rick Burns, director of the PBS documentary series on the history of New York, and with one of the film's commentators, writer Peter Quinn. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews the new novel London Bridges, and John Powers reviews Zoolander, the new Ben Stiller film.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. British writer Jane Stevenson made a splashy debut last year with her collection of four novellas called Several Deceptions. Now she's written her first novel, London Bridges. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says the more Stevenson, the better.
It's fitting that the title of Jane Stevenson's first novel, London Bridges, is architectural in nature. Anyone who, like me, read and swooned over Stevenson's publishing debut last year, a collection of four novellas entitled Several Deceptions, already knows that Stevenson is an elegant writer who's partial to clean lines, sharp turns, and Chrysler Building-type pointed endings. Four Deceptions happily reminded me and other reviewers of O. Henry's short stories, because each novella contained an ultimate aha moment of surprise. London Bridges is a longer literary enterprise, so it's structured differently. Instead of one big vertical exclamation point, this novel is built more like, well, a bridge, whose narrative jolts and coincidences are lengthily strung out. But the most beguiling aspect of Stevenson's writing has nothing to do with architecture or utility. She's really an aesthete, someone for whom a witty, acrobatic story is its own excuse for being. Many of her characters are academics, and her language and references are intellectually adroit. In this novel, for instance, she alludes to William Blake, T.S. Eliot, and Jane Austen, and the crux of the story has to do with a missing Greek homoerotic epic poem. Educated allusions aside, however, Stevenson is not a big idea writer. I think that's why London Bridges, which is stylized and screwball comic in a kind of restrained Barbara Pimish way, has gotten some lukewarm reviews. I enjoyed it, but then I'm also a sucker for those middlebrow Brit-wit sitcoms that my local PBS station airs on Saturday nights. And London Bridges is indeed something of the literary equivalent of As Time Goes By and Keeping Up Appearances. In a pub scene at the very end of London Bridges, a character tidily sums up the gnarled, multi-twists of fate plot here by saying, "What actually happened is we've sort of accidentally solved a crime which no one knew had even happened just by getting to know each other." Those characters who, through flukes, do get to know each other mostly constitute a lineup of the New Britain. Among them are Janine Malone, an expatriate Australian in London to study classical Greek, Dil Desi, a lawyer and first-generation Londoner whose Indian parents operate a sweet shop, Sebastian Raphael, a gay classics scholar, and the villain of the piece, Edward Lupsett, a cash-poor but lineage-heavy old Etonian who works alongside Dil and who resents the energy and the effrontery of anyone who's out of the blue blood mainstream. In the course of carrying out some legal drudgery, Lupsett stumbles upon a trust established centuries ago by the Greek community in London to support an Orthodox church, which turns out to have been demolished in World War II. Lupsett suspects that somewhere in London there's a big pot of unclaimed money that's been accumulating interest for decades. His snooping leads him to a crumbling Dickensian townhouse in a forgotten square where a man older than dirt named Mr. Eugenides presides over ancient treasures, that is, until he's murdered. Meanwhile, the lives of the other characters intersect in unexpected ways until all converge in an outrageous, exuberant chase scene finale featuring druids and eco-warriors on motorbikes. I said before that Stevenson is not a big idea writer, and that's true, but I didn't mean to imply her novel is all style, no substance. Without a trace of politically correct sermonizing, Stevenson revels in the surprising cross-cultural and cross-racial connections, the bridges, as it were, that living in any city inevitably promotes. For a relatively short novel, London Bridges really gives readers a sense of the multitudinousness of London, and it meditates on the cost of embracing those changes that give the city its vitality. Matthew Arnold, the Victorian critic few people read anymore, once talked about sweetness and light as being the two top literary virtues.
Funny London Bridges contains both sweetness and light, although granted, the light it sheds on contemporary London may be too soft and flattering for some cynics' tastes.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed the new novel London Bridges by Jane Stevenson. Coming up, how New York has recovered from crises in the past. This is Fresh Air. When Rick Burns finished his 14-hour documentary about New York, he thought he brought his film up to the present. And then on September 11th, a whole new chapter began. Rick Burns is the brother of filmmaker Ken Burns, and he co-produced The Civil War with his brother. The final two episodes of Rick Burns' New York will air Sunday and Monday nights on most public television stations. They cover the period from the Great Depression to the turn of the century, which was yet another time in which the city reinvented itself in the wake of devastation. I spoke earlier with Rick Burns and Peter Quinn, author of the historical novel Banished Children of Eve, and one of the on-air contributors to the series. Rick Burns has said that for him, the attack on the World Trade Center marked the end of New York's island fantasy.
You know, that was a phrase of E.B. White's from 1949, thinking of the specter of nuclear holocaust in the post-Second World War period. And I felt very much feel that although White anticipated that sense of vulnerability, what it took in the end half a century for it to be made real in the awful way that people imagined the planes coming over and the flames leaping up, but it took a half a century for that to come about. I think that that's very true. I think that our island fantasy of invulnerability, of a kind of, you know, what seemed to me a sort of a schizophrenic cosmopolitanism in which you can be involved in a global commercial system insofar as you get the reap the rewards of it, but you can avoid the mess and the pain and the difficulty. That's clear now that that's an illusion. And there's so many ways in which the kind of the brash, ebullient fantasy of New York has been shattered. And I'm not saying whether that's a good or a bad thing. It's just happened.
Just to take this down to a very personal level, I was trying to imagine myself into your position. You took New York on. You've created this seven-part monolith about this city, and now it's missing its final chapter. And I was wondering, actually, if there are things that come back to you that you have either portrayed in the series or said about New York that now have a different meaning, a different resonance for you.
Oh, it's incredible, Barbara. I mean, the entire film, and especially the last 4.5 hours to be broadcast this week, are filled with stories, characters, events, and themes, all of which the context of their reception changed immediately on Tuesday the 11th. I mean, usually it takes years, decades, for something that you work on to kind of acquire through the accretion of the historical process different meanings. Now, just the shadow of a building, the image on the end, on the edge of a frame of the World Trade Center, now absolutely transforms the way in which you read the film. Obviously, we could never have anticipated that, but it's a very eerie experience for all of my colleagues and for me, and I think actually for anyone who's seen the film, to see it and see that it's now haunted as if retrospectively by the ghost of an event yet to come when the filmmakers made it, which now pervades every frame and it pervades the way you feel and think about the stories and the characters that you're being presented with. Think, for example, of LaGuardia. Fiorella LaGuardia 2 weeks ago felt like a little bit of a different character, a little bit of a historical figure. Now he seems like the very embodiment of our current Italian-American mayor, who has, you know, who's taken the city to his heart and been taken to the heart by so many people around the city and around the country. That is just one of literally hundreds of ways in which the story has been, the context of its reception has been shaped, reshaped.
Mayor Rudolph Giuliani comments in your film, Rick Burns, that LaGuardia took over during the most difficult time ever to be mayor and that he was the perfect person for that time. I think that's, again, one of those moments where you feel this resonating. Here, so many are saying that Giuliani is the perfect mayor for this time and this crisis in New York. It's interesting. They're such different men, but similar in ways.
They are very similar. I mean, they're both autocratic men in many ways, sort of towering egos, terrible tempers, each of them, known for lashing out at the press and their associates, each with a fierce puritanical streak in them, wanting to sort of clean up the city, save it from the abyss of morality into which it seems to be dropping. At the same time, relentlessly honest men, New Yorkers through and through, with a deep and abiding love for the city and its people, and in the toughest of hours, absolutely there, able to speak truth to people, able to provide an example of honesty and courage in the darkest of times, and it's simply astonishing. You know, there's a painting of LaGuardia, which Mayor Giuliani had put over his desk in the northwest corner of City Hall, and he's consciously thought of himself in the shadow of LaGuardia, who is his mentor. I think that what's very, very clear now is there are many ways in which, both intentionally and unintentionally, he has become the successor to LaGuardia. I certainly think he will rank as one of the very greatest of mayors. I think he had a shot at that without this event. With this event, I think it's absolutely a done deal.
They're the oddest creatures, too, in another way. They're both Republican mayors, which doesn't happen very often in New York.
One figure profiled in an upcoming episode is Robert Moses, and he's the man primarily responsible for much of the urban planning in New York in the 20th century, and it was his vision of monolithic glass and steel skyscrapers and a city crisscrossed by huge highways. Peter, could you sum up for us what Robert Moses' vision for New York was?
I kind of grew up with Robert Moses' vision of New York in the Bronx in the 1950s. I remember going down in the neighborhood I was to play where they were clearing apartment buildings for the Cross Bronx Expressway. And his vision was this kind of 19th century reformist idea of clean, orderly highways, the automobile, everything under control, everything under a central authority. It's the antithesis of what New York really is. And he had this kind of modern edge to it where the automobile was the future, dispersing populations. He had no use for immigrants or poor. It was to get on with the business of America, which was going to be lived mostly in the suburbs, people who would drive in the city maybe to work. It was a deeply anti-urban philosophy.
The historian Ken Jackson has said that Robert Moses saw New York as a transportation problem to be solved and set about solving that transportation problem with a vengeance. He had a vision, a grand unified vision of, as Peter has said, a clean, orderly, flowing metropolitan region in which there was no disorder. There was no sort of complexity of sort of human function in any given neighborhoods. The industry was where it should be. The residential areas were where they should be. People had their recreational areas over here. And it all worked according to a model and according to a plan. It unfortunately was a plan which had a kind of abstract beauty and symmetry to it, but wasn't a plan that had anything to do with the way, day after day, a modern democratic society functions.
It was also a plan where the minorities and the poor would be segmented out to make life more orderly for everybody else. So you would build housing projects in Coney Island where people couldn't reach work. So that kind of life of the poor, where in a real city it's intermingled with everybody else, his idea was to put it in a ghetto. And, it was a modern ghetto. It was vertical rather than spread out, but that was part of his vision.
I'm speaking with writer Peter Quinn, also documentary filmmaker Rick Burns. The sixth and seventh episodes of Rick Burns' series about New York airs this Sunday and Monday nights on PBS stations nationwide. Peter Quinn is a commentator in the series. He's also the author of the historical novel Banished Children of Eve. I think one of the most harrowing examples from the documentary series on New York reinventing itself after catastrophe is the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire. And that was a scene of carnage that New York really had never experienced up until this recent attack. And it forced the city to confront the inhuman labor conditions in the sweatshops at the turn of the century. It caused many changes in labor laws and social welfare. Rick Burns, could you revisit for us the circumstances of the fire?
In May of 1911, really one of the worst disasters in American industrial history took place in Greenwich Village off Washington Square. In a sweatshop in a factory, the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire, there was a time before there were any laws regulating the workplace, regulating the conditions, whether or not regulating how many people, whether or not there could be exits, or certainly sprinklers were hadn't been heard of. And on a Saturday evening, shortly before the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory closed for the rest of the weekend, a fire broke out on the ninth floor, and the exit doors were locked. All other means of escaping the building were really rapidly closed off by the very swiftly growing conflagration. And in the end, some 144 garment workers, women, most of them quite young, almost most of them immigrants, European immigrants, were consumed in the blaze or were forced to jump out of the 8th, 9th, or 10th floor of the building to their death in the street below. With that disaster, as with the recent World Trade Center disaster, the eyes of the city and shortly after that, the eyes of the world were fixed on that. New York was the media capital already in 1911. The press rushed up, and a horrified city gathered around and watched this happen.
Rick Burns, how did the public and the city respond to the tragedy?
In a way that's both extraordinary and reminiscent of the response to the recent disasters. As terrible as that disaster was, it coalesced a community of New Yorkers in a way that people who had never come together before came together in the aftermath of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire. The whole city, rich and poor, every profession, every part of the political life of the city, came together and said, we cannot allow these conditions to continue. And so out of the tragedy came both civic unity of a kind that might not ever have existed before, and also the political will and the political consensus to actually make laws, to change laws, to try to ensure that such tragedies wouldn't happen again.
Rick, you decided to change the closing credit sequence for the final episode because of the events of September 11th. Well, why'd you make the change, and why not add a segment or introduction or a postscript, or what was wrong about the tone of the ending?
You know, we'd had the end credit sequence for the last episode was, we thought, an infinitely charming sequence of talking heads, Fran Lebowitz, Spalding Gray, Calvin Butts, Brendan Gill, Donald Trump, each one sort of more irreverent, brash, and ebullient than the next. And we kind of, by nightfall on Tuesday, the 11th of September, New York did not seem like a very brash or ebullient or even very irreverent place. Those qualities that perhaps all too glibly are associated with New Yorkers had just fallen to the ground. And really, for me, the only part of the series that simply seemed absolutely inappropriate in its tone was that sort of cheeky end credit sequence, so we scrapped it, somewhat sadly, and instead chose comments from just two people, from Robert Caro, who wrote the great biography of Robert Moses, and from my colleague Peter Quinn, who's here with us today. Both those interviews had been conducted years before the events of 2 weeks ago, but what they had to say spoke to the themes, the global themes that I think are at the heart, the serious heart of the city's history, and spoke of the degree to which, if we're going to make it as a global civilization, we're going to make it in the way New York has been making it imperfectly for the last few hundred years, making it all together with all the peoples of the world here, with all races, all religions, all ethnicities, all peoples of every national origin here, and finding a way, as Peter puts it in the end credit sequence, to not blow each other up, to not wash out our differences, not deny our differences, but somehow live with our differences intact. That's the experiment that New York has been engaged in for so long. not the creation of a homogenized culture, but the creation of a tolerant, diverse, complex, often very messy culture in which difference is celebrated and tolerated.
Rick Burns, Peter Quinn, I want to thank you very much for talking with me today.
Thanks for having us, Barbara.
Thank you very much, Barbara.
Rick Burns and writer Peter Quinn. Episodes 6 and 7 of Rick Burns' documentary series on New York air Sunday and Monday nights on PBS stations nationwide. Coming up, a review of the new film, Zoolander. This is Fresh Air. The first new Hollywood comedy to open since September 11th is Zoolander. It stars Ben Stiller, who also co-wrote and directed the film. And like a lot of movie comedies these days, the main character was first created for TV. John Powers has a review.
Ever since September 11th, people have been talking about what the attacks might have done to the American psyche, especially the lightheartedness that is one of our best qualities. There's been acute anxiety among creators of comedy, who wonder if they can still make the same jokes as before, or whether the audience wants something deeper and less irreverent. Will the public still laugh at Jim Carrey shooting a cow? It's been easiest for talk show hosts like David Letterman, whose daily schedule allows him to make instant changes. He quickly donned a new seriousness, canonizing Rudy Giuliani rather than mocking him, and saving his jokes for safe, friendly targets like Regis Philbin. Things are far trickier for the movie business, where the film you see today may well have been in the works since the late 1990s. That's why nobody knows whether this fall's new comedies will somehow violate the national mood, or whether they'll benefit from the audience's desperate need for something, anything, to laugh about. The first test case is Zoolander, a ramshackle new comedy made by and starring Ben Stiller. He plays Derek Zoolander, the world's greatest male model, with a patented stare he calls blue steel and all the intelligence of a pet rock. He's so stupid he spells the word day, D-A-I-Y-E. Zoolander's world starts to crumble when he's beaten at the Model of the Year award by a newcomer named Hansel, a blonde scooter-riding dude played by Owen Wilson, who you might remember as Jackie Chan's sidekick in Shanghai Noon. And Zoolander's life gets even worse when he's brainwashed by an evil designer. That's Saturday Night Live's Will Ferrell. He's ordered to kill the Prime Minister of Malaysia, who's hurting the fashion industry by insisting they pay garment workers a living wage. Through it all, Zoolander remains unfailingly foolish and self-absorbed. Here, he's being interviewed by a reporter from Time magazine.
So when did you know you wanted to be a model?
I guess it would have to be the first time I went through the second grade. I caught my reflection in a spoon while I was eating my cereal, and I remember thinking, wow, you're ridiculously good-looking. Maybe you could do that for a career.
Do what?
Be professionally good-looking.
Right.
Ben Stiller made his name doing spoofs on TV, and he has a razor-sharp eye for the absurdities of pop culture. Zoolander itself began as a skit on VH1, and it boasts some clever comic ideas, like the fashion line called Dera Leaked, whose style is taken from the homeless, or the notion of the mystic scooter boy Hansel, who's so plugged in that he travels with his own Sherpa. But while these are good gags, Stiller hasn't escaped his roots in skit comedy. Far too many of the movie's jokes feel secondhand, as if he'd simply opened a Cuisinart and dropped in Austin Powers, Charlie's Angels, Dumb and Dumber, not to mention parodies of The Godfather in 2001. The movie doesn't go anywhere. This might not matter if Stiller were a magical performer like Mike Myers, who has the knack of making silliness seem inspired. But his aura is too neurotic for the part. Even as he struggles to become sweet, dumb, self-absorbed Derek Zoolander, his ambition and intelligence are always there behind his eyes, whirring. The movie's stolen by Owen Wilson, whose smile radiates absolute pleasure in life, and whose odd hippy-dippy timing gives even the flattest scene an off-kilter sense of fun. His presence even boosts Stiller's performance, which suddenly gets looser and funnier each time Wilson comes on screen. The two are buddies in real life, and their scenes together are terrific, especially a male modeling walk-off, and the silliest orgy scene ever put on film. If classic Hollywood comedies were constructed like Swiss watches, in which the nuances of plot and character were made to mesh perfectly, today's comedies more often resemble a drunken game of darts, in which the filmmaker tosses up scene after scene and hopes a few hit the bullseye. In Zoolander, there are few hits and a lot of misses, but Stiller doesn't seem to care. Neither did the audience I saw it with, a preview screening packed with college kids whose desire for laughter obviously outweighed any other consideration. They didn't care whether the movie was any good. They just wanted to escape into familiar goofiness. When singers from NSYNC and Limp Bizkit showed up in cameos, they cheered. Their world was still intact.
John Powers is executive editor of LA Weekly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howell, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Major support for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. Support also comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Anchor Books, paperback publishers of Disobedience, the new novel by Jane Hamilton, author of A Map of the World and The Book of Ruth, and from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, humanitarian aid work in Afghanistan. A talk with lawyer and aid worker John Sifton. He was in Afghanistan earlier this year, in New York City at the time of the attacks, and he departs soon for Pakistan. He's written the cover story for the September 30th issue of the New York Times Sunday Magazine. Join us for the next Fresh Air.